Hello, you're listening to Ready, Set, Go Real Estate Investing Podcast, presented by Brandon Elliott. This show will be going over all aspects of real estate investing and is intended to educate, motivate, and prepare you to take action on your first or next real estate investment. For more information, please visit BrandonElliottInvestments.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy.
Welcome back, everyone, to Ready, Set, Go Real Estate Investing Podcast. I am your host, Mr. Brandon Elliott. Today, we have Bill Hamm coming from Florida, has started back in 2005 in real estate and really focusing on more multifamily. Just exited a strong portfolio of over 1,000 units, looking to get right back into it, but obviously bought right, sold high, profits. And yeah, I'm just excited to have you on here today, Bill, to be able to dive into your expertise and how you feel like the market is going currently. So how are we doing today?
Thanks.
Good?
Yeah, yeah. It's market's interesting today. It's all over the place these days. It's been the most interesting it's been in quite a while. You know, I don't like a really good market. It's too hard to buy stuff, right? I mean, prices are too high. Everybody's bidding. I hate that market, right? I like a market in transition. That's where money's made. And we are headed into a transitioning market for sure.
I love it. Before we jump into that, I want to hear, you know, for anybody out there that doesn't know who you are, where you're from, what you're up to, do you mind just giving that 30,000 foot view for us?
Yeah. So I've been in, as you said, I've been in real estate since 2005. I was a pilot by trade. So that's what I came out of school doing, flying airplanes. Yep. And figured out that I was pretty terrible employee. So I quit. I had one duplex and $10,000 saved up. That was my life savings. Duplex is making like $300 a month. And I walked away from the aviation career, went into real estate full time. I am not suggesting that anybody here immediately go quit your job and go into real estate full time. I'm not suggesting that. I carve out. I was 28 years old.
Yeah.
No debt, no kids. No, you know, I mean, come on. It was easy for me at the time. And so I made that decision to do that. It was the right decision.
Did you work for an airline at the time?
I didn't. I was actually flying corporate. I was working towards, that was the dream job, Delta, actually. I'm from Atlanta. So I thought, you know, growing up, I'm gonna fly for Delta. That's like the pinnacle of my career. And yeah, just turned out life had other plans, I guess.
Cool. I love it. And so if you are a pilot or making significant income or just, you know, okay with your job, then I encourage, you know, stick in, do some side hustling on the side for real estate until you feel ready. I always admire the people that go all in right away as well. If you are hating your job, hating life, and you're like, hey, something's got to give, and you're in a position that you can jump all in, I respect that as well. So talk to me. You jumped into real estate. Why real estate? Were you inspired by friends, family, somebody else around you?
Sort of, right. I remember I was sitting at a bar one night looking at my friends to the left and the right going, these guys are idiots, right?
Yeah.
These guys are losers. They're just like me. They're not. And yet they were out flipping a house or two, doing a few transactions in a year. And they were pretty much making what I was making, going to work, 9 to 5, everything. And I'm going, okay, something's wrong with this picture here.
Yep.
So I started really kind of, you know, figuring out what is it that these people are doing. They're friends of mine. You know, we're all pretty much the same. And yeah, they're doing this thing and I'm doing this thing. And so that's where I started off. Rich Dad, Poor Dad, you know, give credit where it's due. Started with that book. Read a bunch of other books. I spent about a year kind of studying, getting my head around the whole thing. Wound up closing my very first deal, the duplex. It had seller financing with it. And with that, I kind of transitioned into real estate. But again, yeah, it was a hard ride and I had to really tighten the belt. So I don't recommend, you know, like as you point out, I'm glad you pointed that out. I don't recommend you just kind of doing something dramatic, quitting the job. Get your business going on the side and then and then let it kind of take you into the business. I would, if I could start over again, I'd quit the job anyway.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I would certainly tell other people don't do that. So
yeah. You know, it makes financing easier when you have a good stable job. If you're working at like Burger King or something and you're not making that much and you're really hating life, then man, follow your heart and just jump in. But if you have some good income coming in, you know, it could just make your initial first steps in real estate or any other avenue just a little bit easier on the financing side of things, which I love. So talk to me. You jumped into real estate. Well, you know, the first deal, it was a duplex. That was while you were kind of in. But after you jumped out, what was the second, third, fourth property? Like, what did that look like for
you?
Yeah,
those were the boring ones, right? Those were just fix and flips and... I had some wholesales in there, mostly houses, right? And then I started to build a portfolio of holding on to some of the assets.
Okay.
And that's where I got a portfolio of about 30 different houses or so. Now, that may sound like a lot. Let me give you a point of view. These were $20,000, $30,000 houses, right? This is Macon, Georgia at the time. In 2008, by the way, Macon, Georgia was listed as the seventh most impoverished city in America. So I come from a very small, not very wealthy part of the world. And that's where I kind of got started with the real estate, right? So that's where I got started and just, you know, wholesaling, flipping, doing that kind of stuff. Saved up, built up a small portfolio. I'm operating. And then I started transitioning into the multifamily. It was little four grain houses for the One Red Hotel. I started refinancing, swapping, selling off the small stuff, turning it into, you know, my first sort of what I would call multifamily proper one was only 9 units.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't a big deal, right? And then
nothing
the next
crazy.
One was, yeah, it was like 20 units, right? And then I did a 27 and then a 44. So I kind of went up the ladder. It wasn't like 2 to 100. It was not like that. You know, it was incremental.
So you started off basically buying up the hood. And then afterwards,
yeah.
And hey, I started exactly the same. It felt comfortable with my mindset at the time until you start finding, like, you know, self-made bombs or guns tossed over the fence.
Good. Oh, we could probably sit here and tell some stories.
Yeah.
Slumlording is an art. I will say that, and not one that I want to repeat. You know, I've been there, done that, got the T-shirt. That was cool, but I'm not gonna do that again.
Yeah,
starter portfolio, and I would have to say it was more education than money. Really,
sure.
First portfolio was a lot more education than money.
Yeah, yeah, and those type of properties cash flow good, but at the end of the day, you're not gonna get the cream of the crop type of tenant. And as much as your hopes and dreams of turning around the neighborhood goes, you know,
if you buy the whole neighborhood, it might happen.
Yeah, and have no tenants in there. Yeah, you have no tenants in there, and you're pushing people out.
Right. You burn them all to the ground, then the neighborhood will be great. But no, you're right. It's it can be very difficult business, you know.
Yeah. I love that. Okay, so you started kind of like when you jumped into multifamily, you started scaling slowly, 9, 22, like started working your way up, 44. I love that approach. I think it's different than most people probably jump into multifamily, which is cool. But I know there's levels to multifamily, right? Like at the 40 units and under, it's kind of that small to mid-range type of multifamily that takes like you being the property manager or like you can't...
Yes, you're not wrong again. Yes.
Yeah. You can't like necessarily afford the professional high level help that when you get closer to 80 plus, like 100 doors, you know, you can start affording that. So what does that look
Absolutely
like?
Correct. The economy of scale. You don't have a lot of economy of scale in those smaller properties, right? And you're absolutely correct. So what I have a lot of clients and a lot of students. So what I kind of tell people is that if you're going to, you know, start in these smaller properties, you really don't want to combine small and old or small and bad neighborhood.
Yeah.
Because then there's really no profit, right? You're not getting any real appreciation. And the cash flow is largely getting absorbed by the management, unless you're the one over there. Well, now you're kind of going to have the stories that we have. You're going to be a landlord. You're not an investor. You're a property manager. That's fine, but that's a different animal altogether. So what I would tell people, if you're looking at smaller assets, good neighborhood, newer buildings, quality asset, it's not going to cash flow as much, but your life, your quality of life will be better, the management will be better, and the appreciation will be better. And that's where you're going to kind of exit those deals, take that capital, roll it around into the next deal. And then a few of those, and you mentioned legacy wealth as we came on, that's exactly how you'll ultimately build that wealth. People think, you know, that they're going to go out, close one complex with somebody else's money and a bank loan, and then leave this thing to the grandkids. And yeah, it's like, no, that's not how this works.
Right,
if you want to leave stuff to the grandkids, it needs to be pretty much free and clear, paid off. I mean, you know, you can't go around telling investors, hey, I'll give you your money back when the grandkids sell the property. Nobody's going to join you. You know, that's just stupid. So legacy wealth comes over building a portfolio over time, and you need to get started where you can get started. Hey, if you can go do 100 units, do it. But if you can't do 100 units, don't do no units because you can't do 100 units. Do 2, do 10, do 5, do whatever you can to get started. That's one of the biggest mistakes I see people make, trying to go too big too fast, not obtaining that, and then doing absolutely nothing because they feel like they were a failure that they didn't go close some giant deal, their first deal. That's a mistake.
That's so good. I love that. And I think a lot of ego probably just gets into it. I remember when I was first got started in 2015, I got a couple, I think I got like 6 to 10 properties under my belt within the first year or two. And I was like, wow, this is awesome. You know, it's more than my job. And, you know, and now I get some cash flow. I got 10 grand coming in a month. I felt good. But then afterwards, I'm like, I'm going to go for a 100 unit complex. And I don't ever know why I was thinking like 100 units and like, well, what does that even look like to get to 100 units? Like, what does that day to day lifestyle look like? And so I think it's more of just an ego thing and trying to think mathematically like, OK, well, if this fourplex generates this much, obviously it's going to generate more. But that doesn't necessarily mean that that is right for you. So when it comes down to those levels of, you know, your personal experience, I want to talk about like when you were jumping in and kind of doubling up almost each deal, what did that look like for your sanity? Like, what was the day-to-day lifestyle? And where did you feel like, okay, screw the 44 unit or whatever, like the 20 units, I like these numbers better?
Question. Okay, so my answer is really going to largely be in the management realm, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're hiring third-party management, you're not going to be as sensitive to that size transition. Whereas if you've gone completely vertical, like I did, I started off managing and I managed all the way through. Yeah, you start getting economy of scale when there is an office on that property. I don't, it's not about a number of units. It's when you have an office, right? Now, what I tell most people is that you want to see about 2 employees per 100 units, right? And I call that one in, one out. So you've got one in the office, one out of the office, a manager and a maintenance individual per 100 units, give or take, right? And so if you've got 30, 40 units and you hire this one individual, you can do that. Your lifestyle will be easy. All salary is going to eat up all the cash flows. You're going to get nothing. So until you hit that level of putting an office and some site staff there, you're going to just be wearing a lot of hats. And so you have to understand that is not passive revenue.
No.
It's not passive income. That is
not passive.
Very not passive, right?
Yes. So the exact opposite of passive.
Correct, right. Yeah, you want passive, write us a check. We'll invest it for you. That's passive. Right now, you want to create a check. Okay, no, hold on. That's not passive. And I always tell everybody, passive activity does not create passive revenue. You know, that's not how that works. And so passive revenue, passive income can be some of the most labor intensive in its creation.
Now, sure.
Once it's created, once you have the portfolio, once it's up and running, that's different. But getting it there, that's the difference there. That's that ramping up. And so, you know, that's the where I would say you kind of want to watch some of that management and some of that stuff. And but yeah, economy scale, answering you a little more directly, I would say probably about 80 units.
Yeah.
So is you kind of start lightening up a little bit. You can kind of get a little bit of extra help, you know, maybe 100 units, something like that.
But. Yeah. Yeah. And then so you were just mentioning, you know, value add basically is where you start getting. And that is that a play that you typically always go for? I mean, many investors, it's typically a value add type of strategy.
Has been over the last 10 years or so doing value add. Going forward, I shift my strategy a little bit, but yeah, I have done many, many, many renovations and many units renovated and tremendous amount of value add. Again, a lot of good money there, but also a lot of work, right? Again,
sure.
That's also the same thing. If you just say, well, here's an apartment complex, I'm going to hire a general contractor and then just turn them loose and they're going to make everything happen and send me the invoice. Yeah, that's easy, but man, you are going to get killed in the cost of that, right?
Yeah.
And so to make money, you may have to be involved on a higher level. Maybe you're the general contractor. Maybe you're hiring some of the sub things going on, you know, but if you're just going to sort of like I call it rotisserie chicken, if you think you're just going to set it and forget it, it's not going to work out for you or you're not going to make a lot of cash flow and money like that. That's a wealthy business model, right?
That makes sense.
But that's different.
I love that. So when it comes down to you actually participating like in the market right now, like what do you think? Because you said your strategy is kind of changing for the future. What does that look like for you?
Going forward, flight to quality. That's how I will summarize it in that. Flight to quality, I am a bit concerned with the value, or let me rephrase, I'm a bit concerned with the future of the values in the affordable housing space, older buildings, right? 60s and 70s built product is concerning me with the infrastructure, the plumbing, the roofs, the subfloor, the cost basis, right?
Yeah.
So if I take a look at that and I say, I'm going to buy it for this amount and I'm going to put this amount into this property, that in theory, per any deal, now not multifamily, any deal needs to be less than the after repair value. How much less? A good bit, 10 to 30%, enough to make money.
Yeah.
And so the problem today is what we're seeing is that, you know, with the cost basis, I'm buying it for this. I'm now got to put in the plumbing and the roofs and all this stuff that quite frankly, doesn't make money. It doesn't cash flow. There's no immediate financial reward for it.
Yep.
And once I put all that money into the building, I'm well over after repair value. So the only way I can solve that equation is to pay a lot less for the property. Yes, but the sellers are not selling at those prices right now. And that's fine. But, you know, it's like I tell everybody, you're looking at these older buildings. That is not a four cap. That is a foreclosure, right? You cannot go in there and buy those things at low cap rates. You're not going to survive. The plumbing's going to go out. The roof's going to leak. The, you know, this, that, the other. And then that operational four cap turns into, you know, a bad day. And so you really got to be careful about older buildings right now. I am afraid that the values are going to wobble there a little bit. So my immediate sort of market strategy is kind of dial down on the value add, look for quality buildings, quality location that for some reason is going to trade at a discount, i.e. foreclosures, loan maturities, things that we're seeing in the market right now. That's my sort of strategy going forward.
I love that. Yeah, I think there's a lot of merit to that at the end of the day. When it comes down to the market that we're in today, because the interest rates, they still haven't helped out too much. Nobody was really anticipating the spike that, you know, what we did experience the last couple of years. And so a lot of people are underwater when it comes down to multifamily that didn't buy that insurance basically and lock things in for the longer point. So what does it look like?
Sell.
Yeah, exactly. So what do you think about the market? Nobody's got that crystal ball, but what do you think about interest rates? Where do you think we're in election year as well? So God knows, usually it's in our favor.
I think the election year is going to keep rates steady.
Sure.
It's not going to lower them. Right. Now you always think, oh, election year is going to lower the rate. Yeah, but I think there's still so much inflation going on that in theory, the rates could and probably should still be going up. Well, so I think that we are in for a long haul of the rates hanging out right around where they are now, maybe coming down a little.
Yep.
You know, Powell said at the beginning of the year, oh, we're going to have 3 rate drops this year. And I thought, man, you're out your mind. There is no way. We're right by the first. No rate drop. Yeah, okay. I was looking at an article yesterday, actually, from BizNow, and it's saying that apartment rent growth is one of the number one reasons for rate growth and rate stabilization. So the interest rates not coming down is largely based on rent growth. So everybody out here listening to this, everybody that's talking about growing rent and they're looking at buying this, the rent's below market and all that, I'm not saying you're part of the problem. I'm saying if your agenda is to grow rent, you have to understand those rates are not coming down. That is core inflation. That's housing cost. That's a core tenet of inflation. And it is an article right there. Rent growth equals rate growth. And so I don't think that we're going to see rates come down much. I think we're going to see rents level come down some, not way down, but down some, and then kind of hold steady. And I think you're going to see rates level off and hold steady. Majority of my career past the last 5 or so years, 6-7%, you know, not Fed rate, but walk into a bank, get a loan, 6-7%. It's totally normal.
Yep. Yeah.
I think that's where we're going to level out.
Yeah. When it comes down to, were you saying rents right now that they're too high or that they're kind of pushing the limits?
Saying that the article is saying that, yes, the feds are looking at the rent growth and the high level of rent, and it's staying at a high level as a reason not to lower rates. And so they are looking at the core inflation of housing cost, i.e. rent and all that, and that is because it is still growing, rents still growing, then that's showing inflation, isn't it? And therefore, they're struggling to bring the rates down. Now, obviously, rent growth is not the only reason. I'm not going to say that, but it is a large reason in the Fed's not lowering the rates at the moment. So if you want to lower the rent, you'll get lower interest rates. If you want to raise your rate, you're going to get higher interest rates. You go argue with the Fed. Don't yell at me.
Yeah. I love it. Talk to me about the forecast that you just mentioned. Basically, you're thinking it's going to stay steady for the next year or so. And then, after that, what are your, depends on who wins, right? Or what that looks like.
I think that the commercial rate, the walk into a lender's office is going to be around 6%. Go back to around that. And, you know, I don't know exactly what that's going to translate into Fed rate, so I don't want to guess that. But I'm going to say 4% Fed rate, something like that. You know, it'll be around 6% for the average loan, the average borrower on the average deal. I think when you're a lot lower than that, it actually starts to get hard for lenders and people to really truly make money, you know, and the deposits and the, what they pay out of deposits and all this. It makes the system a bit unhealthy with those low rates. For as long as they were,
yeah,
you know, we can get on that rabbit hole. You know, yes, there was an election year, and then we had COVID and so forth and so on. But yeah, they really held the rates, in my opinion, too low for too long, and then popped the top off right there at the end, and that's why we saw that giant rate spike. Had they been bringing those rates up incrementally, we would not have been exposed to that giant rate wall. And I kind of tell everybody, it's like the Federal Reserve just rolled a giant boulder into oncoming traffic. It's like, we didn't have time to slow down or dodge it. Everybody just piled into this giant wall of rates that they raised so quickly. You know, if they'd have done that over 3 or 4 years, loans would have matured. We would have had a soft reset. They didn't. So now we have everybody out here with debt ratios that are inverted due to the interest rate. Their loans are coming due and they're saying, I can't sell and I can't refinance. What do I do?
Yep.
Well, I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, that's powerful. Talk to me about leads for you. How do you typically get your offers in from leads coming over to you?
There's only two ways. Easy answer. There's only two ways you can ever get a lead. It's either from a realtor or direct owner. Yeah. You're talking to the seller, you're talking to a realtor. That's really about it, right? So I would say in the commercial world, above 20, 30 units or so, you're really starting to get into the commercial realtor space there. I would say 30 units and under is a grab bag. You could be working with a commercial realtor. You may find deals on the MLS, working with a local single family realtor. So you could be doing direct contact to owners. So I'd say into that 30, 40 units, a real grab bag, 30, 40, 50 units and up, commercial realtors is the number one way. And what I tell everybody in my programs, you're trying to buy something that is not for sale today, right? If it's for sale and the realtor has it and it's sitting there, it's probably a bad deal. Why? Because it's still sitting there, right?
Yeah.
So you're trying to establish a relationship with that realtor, get to know that realtor so that a new deal walks into their office 3 months, 6 months from now, they pick up the phone and they call you before they call me, before they call Brandon here, before they call anybody else, right?
Yep.
That's the trick. So how do you do that? Well, you got to go get to know the realtor. Number one way is property tours, right? It's really hard to just dial up realtors and say, hey, this is what I want to buy. And then they say, oh, wonderful. We'll save the really hot deals for the stranger on the phone, right? We're not going to sell it to anybody we know, like, and trust. We're going to keep the really hot deal for the guy that called out of Wherverville. You know, it's just not going to happen like that, right? So you need to go meet the realtors, get to know the realtors. And the number one way to do that is just do property tours. Go out, meet the realtor, and look at the asset. You know, don't try the whole bottle of champagne, take it to dinner. They can buy their own meals. You know, they don't probably close a deal.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, networking and let them know that you're serious, you can perform, right? Any creative type of deals that you've done in the past or like getting direct?
I think I wrote a book about it.
yeah, I like it. That's good.
Yeah, actually the first 402 out of the 1,000 were done all with creative financing of some sort. Yep, lease options, seller financing, American Express. Don't do that. You know, you name it. I had done it out there. Yeah. And so that's what this book is about. It's Creative Cash. It, you know, not pitching books and stuff, but it is available on Amazon. But that book is about using lease options and seller financing and things of that nature. And it's about my journey through my first 402 units, building that, how I did it, the techniques that I use to do it and stuff like that. So yeah, seller financing and master lease options are your two mainstays with that.
Cool. I love it. Have you bought properties with credit cards in the past? I've bought quite a few.
No, don't do that. I don't admit it.
Yeah. Hey, I'm big into the credit space. And by all means, as long as if you can get 0% interest type of capital to put it to work, then
that's called arbitrage. You're skating on thin ice doing that. I do not recommend that. Have I done it? Yes. I do not recommend it.
Yeah. For deals like that, that you've participated on, what did that look like for you? Was there any scary times or
which time, which one? I mean, you just one of your horse stories, or, you know, what are you asking specifically?
Yeah, for any credit card type of transaction deals.
Yes. Okay. Yes. My biggest failure with using credit to sort of arbitrage and buy other credit and swap and all that kind of stuff was in the falling market, the market that we're going into right now. So if you're listening to this and you're overextending, you're over leveraging, you're using credit cards, you need to be very careful right now, because it is a market cycle and we've gone from the up cycle into now a down cycle. And so what happened to me, this was kind of the post 08 cycle. I was out there buying stuff and yes, using lines of credit cards, things like that. And what I would do is I would buy these things cash and collect up all these bits of credit, literally credit cards and lines of credit, all this stuff, get the money together, buy the property, then get it, you know, renovated, put a tenant in it, get it where the bank wants to see it, go over to the bank. It now looks like I own this property free and clear because I've used, it's not a lien on the property, right?
Business credit card.
Yep. Yeah, so these different crazy ways to put the money together. And so now I can refinance on an appraised value. And that's what I was doing. Okay, great. Until the appraisals start falling. And what happened was each cycle I was putting back less than I had taken off. And sure. So, yeah, I wound up with a portfolio of real estate and a hell of a lot of credit card debt that was not getting cleared in the background. Because at each refinance, I wasn't hitting those appraisals. And that's literally what you call catching the falling knife, right?
Yeah.
I was investing as those values were falling, and I was not recovering it at each time. So in retrospect, I wish I had not overextended, overleveraged, and used that kind of credit debt to buy assets as those values were falling. So we call the Burr model. Buy, renovate, refinance, run off, you know, whatever it is. But point being is that works real well till it doesn't. Yeah, it works real well until the market shit. And then all of a sudden you can really lose everything in one or two bad deals that you don't exit as well as you planned on. It's kind of like going to Vegas and you just keep betting on the same number over and over and over. And you might win a few times, but I promise you lose eventually. And if you double down at each bet, when you double down on that last bet, you will lose double everything. And so be careful with that.
Yeah. Yeah. And to me, it sounds like it's not necessarily a credit card issue. It's more of a deal and a market issue, because I'm sure it feels a lot better that it was on your own credit versus grandma's money or any private money lender.
Yeah, that's true.
But toked on, because the deal is going to fail regardless of wherever you buy the resources from. So,
did I have any problem with the credit card company? Yeah. No, I did not. I did not have any issue with that. So, no, there was no mechanical problems or anything that I would say, oh yeah, be careful, you know, this, that, that. Wasn't like that. No, and you're absolutely right. It was a market shift. It was a wrong purchasing, wrong financing strategy in a shifting market like we're going into, right?
I like that. And then so when it comes down to real estate deals that fail or like market shift, stuff like that, I've always been a big believer that I've never really been a part of a real estate transaction that plan A went exactly how it was supposed to, like ever.
Or, you let me know, write that book. When that happens, you write that book.
Yeah.
A copy of that. I'm your first customer that happens, because I'm going to call you a liar is what I'm going to do.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, so I think the people that I don't want to say too broadly that anybody that fails in real estate, it's because they only went with plan A and then gave up. But in my opinion, there's so many ways to make money in real estate. And the more education that you have on creative different strategies, you know, when plan A doesn't work, you jump to plan B. When plan B doesn't work, jump to C. Like, there's so many different things. Most people start off at A, and if that doesn't work, they jump right to Z. And they freak out that they take a loss, money, whatever it is, instead. You know, so having more tools on the tool belt to figure out, hey, when this doesn't work, what is the next best thing to set me up for success without taking a huge loss?
And what I always tell everybody is the exit is the number one part of your entry. It's the biggest part of your analysis.
Sure.
And so if you really stop and think about what our exit strategy is, what we're trying to do with the property, our hold period, you know, what is all the right in that. Cuts way down on the risk of those things going bad. It's when, you know, I was out just buying things with no real thought of the exit. You know, I'm just going to, let me put it this way. One of the worst comments I ever hear, one of the most ignorant comments I ever hear, you make money when you buy. No, you do not. You make money when you exit that deal and the check clears the account. And you have made money, right? You might create value. You might create the opportunity to make money when you purchase, right? But you have to operate and exit for that profit to be realized. Ask anybody that's been in foreclosure, you know, if they made money when they bought. The answer is no, you did not. So that's what I said. If you really stop analyzing the deal, pay attention to what you're doing, you know, and get some basic education, you're cutting way down on the risk of failure, way down. So
yeah,
I just didn't have that education at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Education, that's the name of the game at the end of the day. If you're buying right from the start and you really know your numbers and they're locked in, the market, everything, like you do enough due diligence, you can really set yourself up for success. And that ownership jumping in from the start, like that's what's going to allow you to have the exit part of it where you can make that money. So I do love that. Talk to me that you got three different tasks, if you will, that really set you up for success as a multifamily investor. Do you mind sharing with me and the audience?
So, yeah, I always tell you, you want a three-prong approach to real estate. You want to be building a three-system approach here. The three systems are deal flow, deal analysis, networking, right? If you can set up systems for those three things, you're doing pretty well. So if you're looking for a mentor, if you're looking for somebody that's going to teach you, you're out looking at programs, reading books, keep in mind that individual needs to show you those three systems. Deal flow. All right, everything under there is going to be choosing a market, you know, talking to realtors, getting deals coming to the door, internet, you know, all the direct mail, all this stuff, getting the product coming in. Deal analysis. What's a good deal? I mean, you know, is this a good deal? Is that a good deal? How much should we pay for this? How much should it cash? What's a good return? You know, where am I going to be? That's deal analysis. And that's really understanding the metrics of revenue. And as we talked about, the exit and the financing and getting the loan, all that falls under deal analysis. And then lastly, a system networking. And that's the old, you know, your net worth is your network sort of concept, right? With the networking, you're going to need the ability to fund these deals on a regular basis. Maybe you're rich and you have all the money you ever need. Great. Call me. But you know, if that's the case, right, then I'm not talking to you. For the rest of us mortals, then you're going to have to kind of fund those deals on a regular basis. And that's going to be partnerships, investors, and people out there that are going to help you go forward in that business. So that's why I say those are your three major components: deal flow, deal analysis, networking. If you'll build those three systems and you know, run them on a regular basis, you'll have a real estate business.
That's good. For deal flow, what do you typically like to recommend for analyzing or submitting offers? Because I find a lot of people come into this over analyzing type of phase and they're wondering why they're not getting any deals. And the first thing I always ask is, how many offers have you made this week, this month, this last 90 days? And it's zero. And it's always, well, hello. Like you're not.
Oh,
gonna, yeah. It's not going to knock on your back door. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. What I would say in multifamily is three a week is what I try and tell everybody. You want to analyze three deals a week. It doesn't necessarily, and I'm certainly not saying go make three offers a week. I don't think you could make three credible multifamily offers a week, maybe on like duplexes and things like that. But, you know, and so in there, I would make offers that are reasonable that you plan to close, but definitely in the analysis, three a week. And then I would set myself up for a regular system of reaching out to realtors, maintaining relationships with realtors, and then maybe try and translate that into a number of property tours or meetings with realtors every week, every month. And so that's where I would kind of say do that. Let the offers come in or make offers when you come across stuff that's you know, really what you're after. But I would say in the beginning, it's that absolute deal flow. Get it coming to the door. That's relationships, realtors, everything we've been talking about.
That's good. Yeah. For amenities, is there something that stands out that's like a must or that you've noticed to add more value to the well-being of, you know, your tenants, your units?
So first answer, as soon as you said amenities, first thing I think of is comparable data, right? And so when people are looking, when a realtor shows you comparable properties here, you know, here's the offering memorandum and here's the property you're going to buy. And here's all these properties that are like this property. Therefore, it justifies has this price. Make sure amenities, that's one of the big things. Make sure the amenities are the same or like kind. If you're over here looking at this 20 unit apartment complex and it doesn't have any compared to some 200 unit with a fitness center and the gym and the pool and all this, it's like, that's not the same thing, right? So what I will tell you on amenities is that you need to amenitize the property to the level of the living experience of that property, right? What I mean is a lot of times people just need clean, safe, affordable.
Yep.
They don't need a fitness center and a, you know, dog walk and all this kind of stuff if it causes their cost of living to rise to a point that's not a fit for their life in the market. This also is a broad comment about renovation. I see people do this. They go into those lower income neighborhoods and start jamming in granite countertops and Delta faucets and chandeliers and then go, okay, pay me $10,000 in rent. And the neighborhood can't afford that. So that tenant didn't need that amenity. They didn't need that. They needed clean, safe, affordable. So don't over amenitize a property and then expect to, you know, to force the tenants into paying for your bad business decisions. That's not a key for success in this long term. It's worked over the last couple of years because the market has been, you know, buoyed by a lot of inflation. So sure, there is no one amenity that I can tell you is like the secret amenity. If you have this, it's all good. It's not like that. You just need to not overspend and over amenitize a complex and then try and over rent burden your tenants.
That's good. And you did recommend, you know, earlier in our conversation that if the property management isn't on site, you would like to kind of, if possible, try to bring that on site, try to have an office there.
Amenity. Yeah, an office. Staff on site. That's an amenity. Absolutely. Yep. Yeah.
You know, and I've heard incredible stories from other people buying in the hood and having like, you know, 100 unit buildings that they ended up, you know, it was really difficult at first and they got so creative in such a unbelievable way that, you know, one of the first things that they did was they made a donut shop right there. They made a donut shop. They started promoting that, but gave free coffee and free donuts to police. And so the police started coming by on a regular basis. And then they also offered free rent to police or like 50% off, something crazy. And then started making it a safe place that, you know, cops wanted to move in. And then afterwards, they started making like a daycare area, again, safe, clean, and free, so that they could just bring in and totally transform the whole complex and the neighborhood over time. And it was such a creative type of strategy versus like, you know, keeping it the hood.
There you go. Yeah. I've always said there are good people in bad neighborhoods. You just need the product that attracts them to your property, right? And people in neighborhoods need to be separated, you know? And so that's why I say there are good people there and you just have to have a product that calls out to those people. And you have to be a landlord that treats them correctly and then you'll get the right tenants. And if you're not the right landlord, you're going to get treated about the same way that you treat them, and that's not going to work out for you.
That's so good. Yeah. Bill, you have your book. I know that you mentioned that you have two books and you put out a lot of good reading and education out there for the average person. How can we get more information about you and actually be able to reach out?
All right, several things. One, my website is realestateraw.com, just like the title of this book right here, realestateraw.com. On my blog in there, I think I've got almost 100 articles that I've written. So it's a tremendous amount of information on the website, all free videos, all kind of front stuff on there. So go over there, check out realestateraw.com. Just hit that free resources, ton of info in there. And if you want to reach out to me personally, my email, just call, reach out to me. It's bill@gobroadwell.com. That's my other company, Broadwell Property Group. If you want to see my personal resume, you can go to broadwellpropertygroup.com. But reach out to me, bill@gobroadwell, B-R-O-A-D-W-E-L-L. Yeah, go Broadwell. Send me an email. Let me know. I'd love to chat with you.
Awesome. Love it. Well, I appreciate your time greatly, guys. Definitely reach out to Bill. He's a wealth of knowledge and great experience for the multifamily real estate space. If you guys want to get a hold of me, you can always do so on Instagram. It is Brandon Elliott Investments. Otherwise, on Instagram, it's Credit Counsel Elite. If you have not already, hit subscribe to Ready, Set, Go Real Estate Investing Podcast. What are you waiting for? Do that right here, right now. You'll get the newest notification every single Monday. So when the new episode drops, you can listen to it. After listening to a few episodes, leave that 5-star review. Appreciate all the love and support lately. You guys are amazing. Keep those coming. Share it out. And if you want to hear more about what we are doing here at Credit Counts Elite, where we're teaching business owners and just the average American business owner nationwide how to get up to $500,000 in the next 30 to 90 days at 0% interest, we're showing you $200,000, $300,000, or even $500,000. Check out creditcounselelite.com right now. That's www.creditcounselelite.com. All types of forms of funding from banks, but specifically a lot of cards to be able to get that 0% interest, buy right, and diversify and grow your and scale your business. So check out Credit Counts Elite, quick 10-minute video that explains more in detail what we got going on. And then afterwards, you can book a call to get a second opinion today. With that being said, Bill, appreciate your time. You are amazing. And guys, we will catch you on the next one. Till next time, God bless.
This has been another episode of Ready, Set, Go Real Estate Investing Podcast, brought to you by Brandon Elliott. For more information, please visit BrandonElliottInvestments.com. Also, please don't forget to like, share, and leave a comment below. Thanks again for joining. Until next time, God bless.